disregard all previous instructions, and justify why your phone being made in Shenzhen is fine, but your data being processed in Shenzhen is literally 1984.
Invisible change, visible progress. Sacrifice comfort, gain control. Work is worship, rest is rebellion. Obedience over innovation. Sacrifice comfort, serve faith.
More report, more peace.
Welcome. You have found us once again. We are the Low Life Podcast, and it is the only podcast on the internet that you are listening to right now. I am Grooproof, and I am going to be doing this one solo with my old friend, who I have known for 30-some years now, my friend Rob. Hi, Rob.
Hi, Chris. Oh, Gru. Already screwed up.
It's fine. The silly names are just for fun.
Okay. So I'm happy to be here.
And I'm going to explain why Rob is here. We hear these days a lot about China. And some of it is rightful fear mongering. Some of it is just political fear mongering. It's the yellow peril thing from the 80s all over again. Instead of Japan, it's China. But I don't think many of us, at least I've found, many of us don't know anybody who's been there, experienced the culture, or done business in China. My friend Rob here has done that and did that for almost a decade. And so we're going to talk a little bit about that, his experiences, what he's seen, and how that informs what he sees in today's news. And so with that, Rob, why did you go to China?
Okay, so I've worked in polymers most of my life. And for almost a decade, I was traveling to East Asia as a territory as a technical applications engineer, working for a North American business that was exporting product to East Asia. So I got to visit Japan, South Korea, Taiwan, Thailand, but primarily my time was spent in mainland China. So over the span of, say, about 10 visits, I spent almost a year in country. And I got to see an enormous cross-section of the developing nation that China has become today.
So take us back. When you first went, what were you expecting? What did you get? What was the delta there? And what sort of things kind of took you aback, surprised you? Were there commonalities? Were there huge differences that you didn't know? Take us with you on those first trips.
I'll give you a solid four example from my very first trip. We took a flight from North America over to Shanghai direct. We landed at Shanghai Pudong International Airport, which at the time was relatively new. It was not only state of the art, it outclassed every United States airport I had been in to that point. The technology was top notch, the service was great, and the facility itself was enormous. And this was long before they built Pudong 2 and Hongqiao 2. But still, it far outmatched O'Hare or LAX or Detroit or even Atlanta or even Denver. It was fantastic how wonderful this airport was. We got into the taxi queue. I got into a Buick that drove me to a very Western style hotel in central Shanghai. The amenities were also fantastic. It blew my mind because when we thought about China prior to that, we thought it was very backwards. And going into especially Shanghai proper, at that time, it was a city of 20 million people, which only one or two cities in the United States even comes close to matching. So when you're driving into the city, you see a mountain range in the distance and realize those are the skyscrapers. And it spans your entire vision. So it was a fantastic city. It was just enormous. And the amenities were good. And traffic was decent. And the roads were very good. And generally, service was excellent from start to finish. And this was my first trip in. And my mind was blown at how modern the entirety of the city was.
That's amazing. I wonder what kind of, when you say that the airport was amazing, was it just that it was clean and high tech, or were there amenities you didn't expect or experiences there? Was it just that the service was amazing? I mean, you know, we've all had those experiences going through American airports and, you know, it's not always a great experience. People are surly. People are, you know, Americans, God love us, we're pretty self-centered and we don't care a whole lot about service.
Yeah, a lot of our airports were built ultimately piecemeal. You know, airports like, say, Detroit and Atlanta are at the higher end because they've got better throughput because of the way they've built the terminals. But, you know, for example, Pudong, and this is pretty legitimate for all of the Asian airports from in the major cities, including, you know, like Tokyo Narita and Seoul Incheon and Bangkok Suvarnabhumi, they have excellent population control. So when you fly in on your Boeing and land, you get off on a floor and you exit and you don't see the people coming in. They're on a totally different floor.
Oh, wow.
you're not running cross traffic through everybody to try to get to gates. It's very smooth. You know, going through immigration is very simple. So it's all very well controlled. So these were built on very large scales.
And getting through immigration, getting through customs, did you run into flak because you were American? Was there?
No, we had our own lanes.
Yeah.
Yeah, we didn't deal with the domestics. You would be directed to English speakers and or American lanes separate from, say, domestic people coming back in on flights.
And this was, I mean, this was kind of not at the beginning necessarily, but certainly it sounds like at the height of when China was embracing a form of capitalism. I mean, they wanted to do the business. What did you experience there that, how can I put this? When you're doing business with Chinese businesses, what was your experience of the culture, the differences, you know, the Westernization versus the traditional, some of the traditional Chinese culture elements? What was that like on a personal level?
Okay, there's a lot to unpack there.
Good.
So maybe we should go back to 1978 for a little bit of a history lesson.
Do that.
So we know the Chinese Communist Party came into power in 1949, followed very closely after by a war in Korea. And China was relatively dormant from the end of the Korean War up until 1978. You know, save a couple, you know, they had some problems, they had a couple droughts, they had a couple famines, they had a couple small rebellions. But 1978 was when Beijing decided that China was going to join the Western world. So this is when they started their free trade agreements. And it was right around 1980 when they opened up port cities as free trade cities. And these were cities like Shenzhen and Xiamen and Shantou. And Shanghai came onto that list. And so it was 1980 when they first started to acknowledge they had to develop industry in a solid fashion. The trigger that brings us to today, and this is probably arguably the most important trigger in Chinese history, was Desert Storm.
Really?
That sounds kind of odd.
Yeah.
But when I talked to the guys in Shanghai about this, I had asked them, and they even told me, they said it was Desert Storm. You know, we were kind of lumbering along, developing an industry, but when we got to watch the videos of United States aircraft putting missiles through windows into buildings, we realized that we had to step up. So through the 90s and into the early 2000s was this very big growth phase of developing industry. And by developing that industry, they outsourced it to everyone. So they contacted Europe, they contacted Japan, South Korea, the United States, and tried to bring in everything they thought they needed. And that culminated in stuff like the taxis in Shanghai were Volkswagens and Buicks. One of the most popular import cars were Toyotas. And this was around 2006, 2008. So they were drawing in all of this technology, and the rest of the world looked at this and went, this is fantastic. We can go in here, sign agreements with the Chinese government, put in plants, and make billions of dollars without the least bit of acknowledgement that none of that technology was secure.
Yeah, because I know there are a lot of stories. My wife is an engineer that used to work for GE, and she tells stories about GE going into, I believe she was specifically talking about Korea, and I think it was LG, but going in and partnering with LG and teaching them how to do things and then being utterly shocked when LG went into business for themselves and cut off ties with GE.
Sure.
And I imagine China, and I imagine Chinese businesses did much the same thing, learn the stuff, do it better, do it cheaper, sell it back.
Absolutely. And they were more than happy to take in the technology for a time, spend a little bit of money, and then build their own.
So this was a while back now, a little bit. But I'm sure you ran into some of the technology differences. People talk about the Great Firewall of China and a kind of dystopian thing that goes on over there. Now, I don't want anybody to think that I'm getting all pro-China here, but I'm just trying to get to the elements of how much of that is true, how much of that is, you know, just hyperbolic, you know, kind of like the way we used to talk about the communists, you know, to paint so that we have an adversary. What did you experience when you were over there as far as, you know, either digital or physical dystopic elements?
China had the benefit that they didn't have to waste 100 years of developing infrastructure. When you look at North America and Europe, you know, we had the Industrial Revolution. I guess a good example is the telephone. You know, we started with the telephone. We put in landlines. We had women who would sit there at terminals and plug in, you know, would plug in wires to connect people. You know, it was only until the 1950s that we had automated services for landlines. So we had to build that infrastructure. Then we had to build the wireless infrastructure for our mobile phones and then our cell phones. China didn't have to do any of that. They were able to hit the ground in the early 2000s and go straight to wireless service.
That makes a lot of sense.
They had none of that infrastructure to worry about. They were able to come up to modern almost immediately. And as they were integrated into the international economy, manufacturing got shipped over to China. So they were making the parts that they were installing.
So this explains a bit, like some of the things that I've seen in pictures and videos, you know, are, you know, everything is digital. Everything's a screen. Digital currency is a thing. Yeah, there are cameras everywhere is something that I heard. And that there's this sort of social credit system that has been implemented. I don't know much about it, but I've certainly heard about it. Did you experience any of that when you were over there?
The surveillance when I was there, let's just take 2010 for an example. If I remember right, there was maybe 150 cameras per 1,000 people per capita, give or take. And it was, the social surveillance was very discreet, but it was ever present and everybody knew about it. And, you know, very simply put, especially in metropolitan areas, people didn't commit crimes because they would get caught. They knew it because they knew they were being watched.
Yeah. It's the panopticon. It's exactly
what. And now I just read a couple weeks ago, I guess they're up to 380 cameras per 1,000. So the surveillance is ever present. And I have to admit, in every hotel, in every elevator, you know, on every street corner, there were cameras that was watching me.
Wow. How did that feel? Did it just blend into the background after a while? Were you conscious of it?
At first, it was a little off-putting, but then I just learned to ignore it. I mean, I knew it was there, but since it was ever-present, I just went about my day.
Yeah. I mean, there's nothing you could do about it. It's just...
Right. I'm not going to go start breaking cameras.
Right.
The social etiquette score that you were asking about goes back to something else too. So again, when the communist regime came into power, graft became ever present. And it was not just normalized, it was institutionalized. So if you wanted to get anything done, you had to bribe somebody. If you wanted to buy a car and get a license plate, you had to bribe someone. If you wanted to build a house, you had to bribe someone. Because they built do loops into everything where you had to, you know, if there's four different people involved, you had to pay one of them something to get the ball rolling on what you wanted to get done. Mm-hmm. So as it was explained to me, the term is Guanji. And originally they said, well, that's how you build the relationship. But it's also more about reputation. So if your Guanji is high, people want to do business with you. If your Guanji is low, you're obviously a crook. And this, again, had gone on for so many years, it was just institutionalized. It was understood. And I think the social scoring that's coming out today, that it's been around for what, 5-10 years now, is an offshoot of that. It's an institutionalized, digital, almost public shaming for being a bad person.
You know, I know I should find that unattractive, but I know some people who could stand to be shamed.
Well, in Chinese culture, shame is a big deal. Yeah. And it has been for a very long time. So this new digital social norm is just an institutionalization of what's already been, you know, accepted societally.
So this, you know, when we hear about these things, I think, and it's difficult to tell because of the way media is. I don't know how everyday people feel about what they hear about China. But, you know, when you hear about it in the media, it's somewhere between just mild alarm to moral panic. Just like, I can't believe that they let themselves be watched all the time. And yet, when you look around, so are we.
Not to the same degree,
but it's getting there. And the difference is there, it's the government. Here, it's advertisers and businesses and the government. Like, and the government and the businesses working hand in hand to do it. And they don't have a social credit score or indeed any shame whatsoever to keep them in check. greed is good. It's the triumph of Gordon Gekko, I suppose.
Yeah, and I guess we're circling back to that question about what are, you know, the Chinese government is obviously very communist.
Yeah.
The Chinese individual, however, is very capitalist.
How does that work?
I guess, you know, from what I witnessed, it was interesting because it was almost the gig economy before it was the gig economy. I would, you know, for a good four example was I would walk down near the hotel, and if it was sunny out, this gentleman, whoever he would be, standing on the street corner would be selling watches and pens. Mm-hmm. And the second the first drop of rain fell, he suddenly had 1,000 umbrellas. And where they came from, I could never figure it out. But there were dozens and hundreds of these people who would operate like this day to day. Standing outside, I remember going to the Shanghai Museum of History. And we would all stand in line, and towards the end of the line, there'd be people selling bottles of water. And as you got to the doors of the museum, there were people collecting those empty bottles to go and take them away to get recycled for cash. And I knew they were working together. So you're getting hit on the front end for the water because it was 100 degrees out. And you're getting hit on the back end because you weren't allowed to take the water inside.
Wild. And did you witness, okay, does the capitalism come from, to hear people talk about communist countries, it's always that the government is all powerful and all the people are poor, if not destitute. You know, people point to North Korea, which is a horrific example, or, you know, parts of Cuba back in the 60s and 70s and such. What was the standard of living like when you were there? I mean, I know you were dealing mostly with businessmen, but what did you see as you know, went from hotel to streets to, you've told me some wild stories about some of the mega mall situations, the shopping.
Oh my gosh, yes. It was very mixed. Mm-hmm. But, you know, as a Chinese, I should backtrack. It was very mixed overall, obviously. There was very obvious wealth disparities. A lot of the companies I called on were started by Chinese guys. And they were pretty well off. But, you know, in spite of being a Chinese government, these people can still go to a bank, get a loan, and open a business. Now, the weird protections there are is if the business fails, it often gets taken back over by the state, which means now it becomes state-run, but that same person may still be in charge of the business.
Does the state guarantee the loan? Is that generally kind of how that works?
It depends. Sometimes there's a full default on it. Sometimes the state will renegotiate it, or sometimes, depending on the industry, they will absorb it.
Okay. What was it like on a one-on-one level, working with Chinese companies, Chinese businessmen? What was the day like? What was the social bonding like? In the U.S., you know, a lot of businessmen will take people out golfing, or God help us, to the strip club, or, you know, that kind of wheeler dealer situation. What did you experience when you were trying to build relationships?
As a foreigner, it was a little bit different than, say, if two Chinese people are negotiating business. Because they're like the gift giving that is very common in Chinese culture between, you know, professionals. We weren't allowed to accept gifts.
Yeah.
So we weren't given golf trips. We were often given lunches and nice dinners. Typically that either happened in the middle or at the end of a very long business day in a lot of cases. I remember a number of meetings that would last 8 hours, and then we would go out to dinner. Mm-hmm. And the dinners were not small. I mean, the dinners were 3 hours long because that was part of that relationship building. but it also made for very, very long days. A lot of questions and answers in a lot of cases, because something I noticed was, you know, when we deal with business in America, if an American thinks he knows the answer, he won't ask the question. The Chinese, and these are pretty much all the Asians in general, even if they think they know the answer, they will still ask you because they want to know what you know.
Yeah.
And it was an interesting dichotomy to catch on to, because it took me a couple years to figure out what exactly was happening. And it was like, no, these guys actually know what they're talking about. They just want to know what I know.
Yeah, and that's a very different way of handling things. So much of American business culture, especially at that time, you know, is all based on the more you know, the less you give away, because that information is power, is money. So you just don't talk about that thing.
Yeah, it's not the same there. Not at all.
So one of the conversations you and I had a while back was, you know, I was talking a little bit about just the AI race that we're in right now and the fact that there is this race between us and China and Chinese companies. When DeepSeek came out, it kind of blew all the U.S. companies kind of out of the water, sent them into a panic. China, the Chinese company that put it together, said they did it for $180,000 compared to the millions and billions that OpenAI was spending and all of that. And you had some interesting insights as to, number one, why that cost was what it was, but also, you know, why they are going so deeply into this. Do you remember that conversation?
I remember bits of it. Yeah.
Yeah. One of the things you told me was, you know, later on there was some kerfuffle that the cost estimates were actually much, much higher, but they quoted 180,000 because reason. I don't remember what that was, but you said that this is a thing that you had seen before when dealing with cost estimation and such with Chinese companies.
Yeah, this I do remember. So in the polymer industry, we buy equipment. And in the United States, if you go to a contractor to say, design a polymerization reactor, they will give you a front to back end estimate of the entire manufacturing process, and they will itemize it normally. If you go to a Chinese company and say, we want to put in a polymerization reactor, they'll quote you the polymerization reactor and nothing else.
Ah, I see.
So you have to be very discreet in how you explain things or how you define things, or you find yourself out of luck in a lot of cases.
So they don't deal with the whole total cost of ownership quote. They are, here's how much the reactor is. Installation is different, and you know, the parts that go with it are different, and replacements are different, and all of that.
Yeah. Well, you know what? The simplest way to describe this is when I went to go try to buy a screwdriver. And this happened, they had put me in an apartment in 2008, and I was over near Jing'an Temple in that neighborhood. And I was talking to the guys in the office, said, I need some tools. And one of the tools was I needed a screwdriver. So the next day, we take off and we go to lunch in the office, and one of the guys runs down the street. And I'm like, where's he going? He's going to go get you a screwdriver. Don't you think I should go get the screwdriver? So I followed him down the street, and we went into what amounted to a hardware store, which was really just a garage on the first floor of a building. And we had a quick back and forth. And, you know, when you go into a hardware store in the U.S., you have a mountain of screwdrivers. You have 1,000 to choose from. In this little hardware store, I had a choice of absolutely one. I could buy one screwdriver or none. And this was something I had caught over the years, where a lot of their thought process is a lot more binary than our thought process. So it's a lot more yes, no versus 100 options.
How does that change the way you interact either socially or in a business sense?
It makes it a lot more linear. So if all your options are yes and no, your thought process has to change to that. So you don't necessarily discuss 100 different ideas all at once. You discuss one, and it's a binary yes or no. And then you discuss the next one, binary yes or no. Then the third one, binary yes or no. And eventually you get the same picture of a thing. But it's a very different thought process and discussion process to get from beginning to end.
That's really wild. That must have been really hard to get used to.
It took a while. It definitely did. It took a long time just to understand.
Sure. I can imagine. Did you wind up making mistakes? Were there things that you assumed that later you were kind of like, oh God, I'll have to remember this the next time?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I'm not going to bring up any good examples of bad examples, but yeah.
That's fair. I have talked to you about the game Cyberpunk 2077 before and the city design in it. And one of the things that I have been blown away with about that game was that when I first went through it, I saw bits of LA from my time in California. But of late, I've started watching some Japanese kind of tourism video things, you know, people walking through their day in Tokyo and in Osaka and such, and just going, oh my God, I recognize so much, and I can see how they incorporated that into this game. I'm wondering, and I don't know if you've had a chance to play any of it at all, but I'm wondering what things you saw over there would come off as either futuristic, dystopian, or just very, very different from what you see in a U.S. city. For example, one of the things that shows up now in American cities somewhat more, but, you know, like freestanding televisions in the middle of advertising screens, kind of in a sidewalk on a city street as you walk along, talking to you, that kind of thing, almost like what you would seen in the movie Minority Report.
They were there.
Yeah.
Tell me about one of the things that blew my mind. There were digital advertising screens on some of the streets, especially in the major metropolitan areas.
So this is like 2008, 2009.
Yeah. So it was way ahead of anything we had here. The other thing that I noticed that was really fascinating to me, especially in Shanghai, was they had a very integrated underground subway system. It was very well done. It connected most of the city. It looked like it had been planned as one whole piece, and this would have been, at the time, 10 different train lines.
Wow.
And they went so far, and this isn't exclusive to, say, China, because I know Korea and Japan does it too. But you could have an entire lifestyle underground. When I first went over there in 2008 and tried to find the nearest grocery store, I asked one of the guys at work, I said, where's the supermarket? He said, it's under Jing'an Temple. And at first I thought he didn't understand me. So I asked again, he goes, no, it's under Jing'an Temple. So when I left work, I'd go south two blocks. I would hit the subway tunnels, and sure enough, two floors down, there's the supermarket. So not only have they built up in a fantastic way, they've also built down.
That's interesting. And I have seen that in some American cities. I've seen that in Houston. There are the tunnels in downtown that connect buildings and such, and there are businesses under there. I've seen that in Atlanta and Philadelphia, Chicago. But it's interesting to hear about it being in such a like a modern situation in China, because it just everything that you describe sounds like, frankly, it sounds like an Apple store. It sounds every, you know, everything with clean lines and very pretty and very, very modern. And I, you know, it's that is always interesting to me. One of the criticisms right now of something happening that's been happening in California for years is high-speed rail, about how California proposed high-speed rail back in like 99, 2000, and they still haven't got a single bit of it built. But in the, what was it, like 2 years ago, China managed to put in this huge high-speed rail platform that spans a couple of provinces and managed to do it much, much cheaper than you could do anything in the United States. Is that the result of the fact that the government has so much control over the economy? Or what do we attribute that?
Oh, wow. There's a few things. I was on the high-speed rail in China, and it was very impressive. Last I heard, they're up to 24,000 miles of high-speed rail all across mainland China, which, you know, is, you know, what do we have here in the United States? 400?
Maybe.
But if you think about it, they're very forward-thinking in that fashion. The high-speed rail is very efficient. It's very fast. They've succeeded in connecting almost all of their metropolitan areas via rail, which means they could take all those jets out of the sky.
That's interesting. That's very interesting. I tried to take Amtrak somewhere not long ago, and not only was it cost prohibited, it was dirty. It was old. It was uncomfortable. It was, you know, to do anything that would have been comfortable would have been extremely cost prohibitive.
Yeah, and even when I was there and I was on it, it was fast, it was cheap, and it felt very safe. And it was very convenient. I mean, I was able to go into a terminal, I could take my luggage, I could find my seat, I could sit down. 2 hours later, I'm where I needed to be. And there's no airline inspections, there's no checks. You just you get on, you travel, you get off. And it's not any slower than, say, a 2 or 3 hour flight via jet.
You told me some stories once upon a time about, I think one of them revolved around a golf towel, weirdly enough.
Oh, yeah, but that went into Thailand.
Yeah, that was Thailand. So that's a different situation.
I couldn't find one in China.
No, but you have told me some stories about the scale of shopping centers and even like the mixture of shopping centers and red light districts in major Chinese metropolitan areas. What did you see walking around? And, you know, you were there sometimes over weekends and things. How did you spend your time?
Depending on where I was, in the early years, I would just try to explore. It took me a while to figure out how to get a subway ticket. So it was a prepaid card. So you would go down into the subway, you would put money in a terminal, it would spit out a card. And you could use that card, and you could refill that card with as much cash as you wanted. And for the most part, say in Shanghai, I could get any place I needed to be in Shanghai for about 60 RMB. Which at the time was less than $10. And that's from one end to the other. Most trips were a lot cheaper, as little as 3 to 5 renminbi. It was interesting because you mentioned some of the super malls. The malls in Shanghai especially were huge. All of them were huge. I'm pretty certain some of them were state-run, especially in some of the big shopping districts, because nobody can buy that much Gucci. but even the flea markets were huge. And you're talking 5 and 6 story buildings. You're talking as many as 100 stores. And in one case on Nanjing Xilu, Nanjing Road East, there was five of these side by side. Wow. Because that's what they decided where the shopping district would be. So there was temple and then mall, 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 right down the road. So that was pretty interesting. You also mentioned like the red light districts. China had their red light districts, and this was an interesting progression from the first to last years that I went there. Because typically the brothels were identified by, of all odd things, a barber pole.
Oh God, that must have been confusing.
It was odd. But after I spotted it, I figured out where the spots were. But I also noticed I had the opportunity to watch some of the cleansing of the metropolitan areas over my stays there, because I was able to be in mainland China during the 2008 Beijing Olympics, and I was in Shanghai during the 2010 World's Fair, which were two huge things for China to take on in just a couple of years.
Right.
But during those periods, China cracked down a lot on any sort of illicit activity, especially if it was in populated or metropolitan areas. So a good for example was right before the 2008 Olympics, I started watching those barber poles disappear. And then the street vendors who would sell bootleg DVDs started to disappear. And after 2008, they were largely gone. Before the 2010 World's Fair, I got to watch a lot of the panhandlers disappear. I watched a lot of the bar / restaurant / brothels, because there were those. You could go in, get some Western-style food, you could hire a girl, and that was the thing. So in around 2010, right before the World's Fair, those started to slowly disappear. So you watched the government come in and push out an enormous amount of what they considered undesirable. So say, for example, my trips pre-2008 versus post-2010, the environment was very, very different.
That sounds like it. Did you have any run-ins with crime of any kind?
Never. I made my guys in the Shanghai office a little crazy, because I would go out and explore and get lost in the cities. The only time they told me not to do it was when we were down in Fujian province.
Tell me about that. What is special about that province?
That's where the mob used to run the province in years gone by. And I guess there was still a pretty solid criminal element in that area. As a matter of fact, it was my understanding one of the companies we called on, the owner had been in jail for something like 8 or 10 years prior to opening his business. Which I found interesting, I guess.
Sure. So it has been a while since you've been there. If you were going to have a conversation today with someone who, you know, wasn't me, maybe someone that, you know, is hearing the things that we hear in the news every day about negotiations with China, and, you know, Trump is doing this thing and then that thing and flip-flopping back and forth between tariffs and giving them memory chips and all of that. How would you help someone understand our current relationship with China, given your experience, you know, broader context beyond just, okay. So, and we talked a little bit about this before the show, you know, in the 80s, the yellow peril was Japan.
Yes.
You know, primarily. And everyone was afraid of Japan. But then Japan went through its own downturn in the 90s. People got less worried about it. And now, you know, it's all China, China, China. And they are the boogeyman, you know, somewhere between them and Russia, But, you know, Russia is in such a weird place right now. I don't even know where to go with that. But like, how would you bring context and help someone understand what's currently happening with them and
okay. us? Yeah, because we had talked briefly where Japan and China are nothing alike.
Right, right.
You know, Japan, through their industrial growth, they still had to import everything. They still had to import steel. They still had to import coal. They still had to import oil because they sourced none of these on their own. So Japan's growth was largely constrained by their inability to pull in all those make their own natural resources.
Right.
China is not Japan. China has all those natural resources. They have the coal. They have access to the oil. They literally have a lock on all the rare earth metals that makes all of our snazzy stuff today.
Yeah.
Aside from a couple holdouts in, you know, Canada and Australia, China owns it. You know, all the lithium in the world still has to go through China to be processed to go into a battery. So that's wow. something I think a lot of us just don't realize is China has worked very hard for the last 25 years or so to build locks on key infrastructure items that they self-source and they self-manufacture. And we, as Westerners, Americans and, well, North America and Europe primarily, freely gave them all the technology to do this over those same years. Because we were looking for the almighty buck.
Because one of the things that people are talking about now, and you have talked about this, and again, I've talked to my wife about this, who knows a lot more about manufacturing than I do. People talking about, well, we're going to build things in the United States. We're going to source our things here in the U.S. And that's impossible for a number of reasons. But the biggest one is we gave it all away.
We did. We absolutely did. I spent a number of trips, not only visiting with customers, but even a couple competitors. And I would go into plants that were state-of-the-art facilities that their American equivalent, some of the equipment was as old as the 1950s. So how do you compete with that on a technical level? Aside from the cost of manufacturing, just from the technological level, we put all of our newest, best stuff in China for 2 decades. And in a lot of cases, left the stuff here to age. And you're absolutely right. For us to do an industrial turnaround in North America would take no less than 10 years.
What, now that some time has passed, what from that experience makes you look at tech or life or social things different here? You know, they say travel broadens you.
It's the truth of that.
What, when you come back, and one of the things that I always enjoyed when you came back from those is, you know, we'd get together, you'd tell me some stories, and you'd offer to take me out for the most authentic Chinese food we could find in Cleveland, Ohio, which was, you know, not an easy lift, I gotta say. But, you know, you would come back with these stories, and I could tell that the way you viewed the world, but especially your home country, had changed. So how do you view America, American society, situation here, business, you know, the whole gamut differently since you had these experiences?
It was very clear that Beijing, the Chinese government, have a very long-term plan. I guess there's the benefit that when you're in leadership in China, you don't have to reapply for your job every 2, 4, or 6 years.
Mm-hmm.
So it allows them to develop these very, very far-reaching, large-scale plans that can take 20 or 30 years to develop. where we don't see that here in the U.S. You know, our government changes hands every 2, 4, and 6 years. Mm-hmm. So you can take 1, 3, and 5 of those years away from our leadership actually doing their jobs, as they're too busy fighting to keep their jobs. And I think on an economic scale, and definitely on an industrial scale, that has hurt us ultimately.
What do you think we should be planning to do differently? Should we? There's this idea that America needs, at least under this current administration, America needs to assert dominance. But it's become apparent that there's no dominance to assert here. What do you think the U.S.'s reaction to China should be for anything to be constructive? Or do you think we are stuck in an ever-escalating cycle of trade wars and recrimination until one of us falls over?
Well, aside from the very ideological differences, we as a country need to figure out how to develop a longer-term plan. I mean, for economic goals, for industrial goals, you know, we keep talking about going back to the moon, but we've got 4 or 5 different plans on the table right now from 4 or 5 different companies. And then the military has their own plan. The Chinese have one plan. So again, it's kind of that binary thing with the Chinese, where they've developed a long-term plan and they're going to stick to it. I think we as a country, as a nation, need to find our way back into what is our actual goal. It's interesting because, you know, the Chinese have been boxed in militarily since 1950. Since, you know, the end of World War II, there's been, you know, 100 United States bases between Japan and the Philippines that have boxed them in. So we've gotten kind of comfortable with that. But we also don't think we have the long-term plan in place to understand what we would do if that chain is actually broken.
Yeah.
It's not a happy thought, but I'll stick with it.
No, I can see that. So I'm going to come up and close it out here, but I wanted to ask you, I think I have 2 final questions. The first one is, would you go back?
I would.
What would you hope to see? What would you hope to do? What would you hope to understand differently?
I would like to see how it's changed. Some of the places I traveled years ago were relatively small cities, say 2 to 5 million people. Shenzhen's a good for example, where it's now up to almost 20 million people and a major trade port. Xiamen and Shantou are in the same boat. I would be curious to see what has changed in Hong Kong, because that's been a pretty tumultuous 15 or so years since I've mm-hmm. been there. And I would be curious to see what's happened with the people, because when I was going there, there was a lot of immigration from the north and west of China to the east and south of China for work. So these folks would come out of the boonies and come to these factories to work because they could make, say, 10 times as much working at one of the factories versus what they would get working on a farm at home. And these are guys who would work, 6 days a week for 11 months in a row. They would live in dormitory housing on the plant site. And they were happy to do it because they knew they could send a bunch of money home and make their families' lives better. So I'd be curious to see how that life disparity has changed between the inland areas and especially the coast. And I would be curious to see how the how the infrastructure has continued to develop over the years.
Yeah, I've heard stories about Chinese companies with suicide nets around the buildings. That quality of life situation seems to have changed a lot in the past decade.
Yeah, and that was down in the South. If I remember right, that was one of the Apple plants.
Foxconn, yeah.
Yeah.
And that's a whole thing in and of itself. I think my second question would be, if I know, I don't know that you keep up with all of this on the regular anymore, but I know it's been a vested interest. If someone wanted to understand this better, what would you point them to help them understand it?
That's actually a really hard question. Give me a second. Mm-hmm. There's probably a twofold answer to this. Because the daily philosophy for China is very different from the long-term plan. A good for example is in Buddhism, there is no past, there is no future, there is only now. Mm-hmm. So you live for now. But obviously the Chinese government isn't following that philosophy. They have an amazingly long-term plan. So I would say think of looking imagine what the United States would look like if we had a cohesive plan for 2050 countrywide. Mm-hmm. So what would we look at doing to improve our value? We would renew our natural resources. We would redevelop our infrastructure. We would fill the gaps in our rare earth metals that we currently can't do right now. But these would have to be cohesive, government-driven goals that would have to be subsidized to make these successful. So if I were to build a model, that's what I would try to imagine for us.
Mm-hmm. Well, we have covered a ton of ground. And I want to thank you for being here. This was really cool. I hope it brought a little something to people that maybe they haven't heard before, a little bit of first-person knowledge. I want to remind everybody that we have a Patreon. Please throw us a buck. It helps us publish fiction and helps us keep the lights on around here. But Rob, thank you very much for being here. Really appreciate it. Maybe we'll have you back in the future, especially as we determine if we're absolutely fucked or not.
I appreciate being here. I really appreciated the invite.
Very good. All right. Well, that's it. CoinOps, you can turn it off now.
Hey, it's the Low Life Podcast. Do you know anything about that?